Hello, cyclocross friends, and thanks for tuning in to episode 184 of Cyclocross Radio. On today's show, we're talking to Chris McGovern. Chris McGovern, he's a coach, he's a frame builder. He ran cyclocross programs at the college and the federation level. He was a professional road racer, professional cyclocross racer. He races ultra marathons now with his feet and running. He's done it all. It was great to catch up with Chris. We talked about his racing and also his coaching and just a wide range of topics that I think you'll dig that really fits in with a lot of the conversations that we've been having recently on the show. We're going to get to that in 1 minute, but before we do, I want to talk to you about Works and the Works tools. If you go to yourcleanbike.com, put in the code GEAR UP. I think it has to be all caps. You'll get 15% off everything on that page. The one tool I want to highlight for this week is the SD driver with screw holder. We've all had those little electric screwdrivers before. This is the most amazing one I've ever used. The screw holder is ingenious. Just put the screw in there, it grabs it, and then it sort of lets it go as it goes into whatever you're screwing it into, the wall or whatever. It's really amazing. And then you get to like pull it back and it's got like this sort of six shooter cartridge in there. So you just spin it around to change your screwdriver heads. It's a lot of fun. I love it. And it's not that expensive. And with the 15% off, you're getting a huge deal on it. Yourcleanbike.com, code GEAR UP. Get that. Get everything else. Get all those home projects taken care of since you got nothing else to do right now. Also, hey, while you're doing nothing else, go to YouTube. Go to CX Harris page and check out The Rough Draft. It's a new YouTube show that I'm doing with the Media Pit boys, Zach and Michael. And we've invited super rookie Tim from the Slow Ride podcast in there as well. It's about 5 or 6 minutes each episode. It's a really fun take on just everything that's going out there in social media and cycling news today. I think you guys are going to dig it. I think some of y'all have seen it, but really wasn't sure what's going on with the title. But it's a lot of fun. It's cycling related, not necessarily cyclocross, although we snuck a lot of that in there. Go to youtube.com/CXHairs. You'll see 2 episodes so far of The Rough Draft. Finally, everything at Wide Angle Podium. That's, you know, The Rough Draft I just talked about. That's part of Wide Angle Podium, along with all the other shows. We're just pumping out the content. You should not be wanting for anything to put into your ears. Please do it. Even if you're not listening right now because you're at home, you're not commuting, keep downloading those shows. It helps us a lot. And we love making the shows for you. So check them all out. All right. We're talking to Chris McGovern, and we're doing that right now. Now that we figured out Zoom, how's it going there? Where are you? You're in California, right?
I'm in Nevada City, California, about an hour and 20 from where Reno Nationals was. I'm in between Reno and Sacramento, basically, on the west side of Donner Pass.
And just work-wise right now, coaching-wise, everything else you have going on, making, but God, there's so much that you do. I don't even know where to start with that, but routine pretty much the same?
Yeah, it's good. Like, you know, the coaching is good. The athletes, I think people are really realizing like how important the routine of exercise and sticking to it and working towards something. You know, obviously we've had to bob and weave on what we're working towards, but, you know, we found opportunity in most of that, so everything's been pretty good there. Frame building, of course, is going pretty good. I build all the wheels for Hi-Fi Wheels. Hustling.
Yeah, absolutely. That it's an interesting, just the goal part is something I really hadn't thought about that much, but yeah, that's got to be really tough because I'm sure that with the athletes that you coach, you're mapping out beforehand, all right, this is your A goal, this is your B goal, this is what you want to do, and now it's so up in the air.
Well, what's interesting to me and what I find with the North American athletes in particular is, you know, if you had a good cross year, it's pretty mellow after Worlds or even after Nationals. You know, like, okay, I'm going to take a good break, I'm going to come back. I want to do all the little things right before we get to like the big, big important training. And then you have the athletes that didn't do, have like a stellar year, and they're like, okay, I got to do U.S. Cups. I got to be at Redlands. You know, they got to be somewhere and they got to be ready to hit. And so you get this, like, it's almost like cramming for finals mentality. You know, your cross season didn't go the way you wanted, and so you're like, you got to validate all this work quickly. And so with that all off the table now, it seems like everyone's kind of come full circle to like, okay, yep, we got to pan back a little bit and think big picture.
Do you have anybody peeking for Zwift races?
No, no, I don't. Yeah. I mean, some of my athletes are super into it. And some aren't, and some are trying it, some are toying with it, you know, just cause it's like, depending on where you live, like if you can go out and ride outside, it's probably, you don't need it. But if you're, you know, trapped and you can't, then you're probably like, well, I think I'll dabble.
Let's go back with you a little bit. I think people may have heard your name through coaching and through the frames, and maybe even through like running some of the cyclocross programs. It's getting farther and farther away from people who knew you as a bike racer, I think.
Right. Oh yeah.
But yeah. I mean, as far as I know, you were basically racing bikes out of the womb.
Yeah. I started racing BMX about 5 years old. And that turned into road racing around 13, you know, moved to Europe the day I graduated high school, started racing cross in 1986. So it's been a big part of, it's been my entire life, really.
I didn't realize. I knew you as a road racer, like on basically every domestic team out there, Health Net, right?
And I was on Health Net, Jelly Belly. Here in Nevada, raced for Mike at Zaxby's.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Oh yeah. 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 Yeah.
See, all these shows I've been doing recently all seem to tie together.
Well, and then Terry Buchanan and I raced together. My wife's from Washington, so we lived up there. After college, I moved up there and I raced with Terry a lot, you know, and had the pleasure of standing on the podium at Starcross with Kabush and Andy Jacquemain and winning SeaTac the following day. You know, it's just, there's some story. I was like really stoked on your episode.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Just because the West Coast, you know, even when they were just like, sorry, USA Cycling, like the cross is still awesome. Our Sacramento series is like incredible, you know?
Yeah. And even to the history of cyclocross, as much as I think New England would love to claim it, it really is, you know, Northern California where it all kind of started in the U.S.
Yeah. I will give New England props for refining it, because
for sure,
those early days across, it was like, it wasn't a question of if you were going to get poison oak, but like how much and where, because you were going to be like crawling at some point on the course. There was no doubt. But, you know, Bob Leibold, Velo Promo, he, you know, did it and got it done and put on these great races. It was fun.
Yeah. So I started racing cyclocross, you know, I still think like it wasn't very long ago. It was early, probably 2003. And even then it was still, you know, it was still some jungle cross elements out there. Yeah. It was kind of like anything goes, but just from what I've heard, it was nothing compared to 80s and 90s racing cross.
Pretty wild, man. It was pretty wild. Yeah, I would say New England and then like Supercross or Super Cup really kind of brought it to a whole new level where you were just like, damn, that guy's got two bikes. Like, you know, no one had two bikes. It was odd if someone, it was like, you know, Don Myra had two bikes, Clark Natwick had two bikes, Daryl Price maybe had two bikes, you know.
Don Myra, yeah. Man, he's still out there doing it.
Yeah, he is, but you know, that guy, he was early.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Europe after high school. Tell me a little about that. That must have been an adventure.
Yeah, you know, I was racing for Plymouth Reebok here domestically, which was, you know, it was better than most professional teams I raced for, and that was a junior program. It was far better than the national team, which I was also on the national team. But the support was incredible. The infrastructure was incredible. The training logic was incredible. You know, Greg LeMond was very involved in our kind of our general training, kind of by age category, like you're going to do this much volume at this age, that type of deal. And I was just like, possessed with the bike. Like, you know, school didn't interest me at all. I kind of wanted to be an architect, and I was not interested in doing the math required or the 20 hours a day of school required to do that. And so I was just like, I'm going to go race in Europe. And Paul Willerton, who was a teammate of mine at Plymouth Reebok, had just signed with Zed on Greg LeMond's team in Europe.
Yeah,
and he, this is like, he was probably one of five Americans in Europe. And, you know, he was like, look, I can find you a place to live with someone who speaks English, and you can come over and race bikes. And that's what I did. Lived with this Australian guy, got connected with a bike shop, and, you know, you're only allowed to race 3 days a week as a junior. I think it was three times a week. Yeah, three times a week as a junior. So it's pretty much no training. You just race and rest and see what happens.
And how long did you do that?
So my first year, I went over basically beginning of June, and I was there until middle October. I was still a junior. I won 11 races over there, like in that time span. And I was just like, oh, Tour de France, here we come. Right. And I signed with the regional team outside of Kortrijk, Belgium there. This is still, you know, amateur pro. Mm-hmm. They were called Thermat van Halst, and, came back in the following January and just was so not ready, like not even remotely close to make that jump from junior to amateur racing. And I stayed over there for another 3 or 4 years, you know, kind of making small gains, but really just getting my face kicked in on the regular.
What years were this?
Let's see. I graduated high school in 91. So I was over there till I came back in 90, 95. Yeah. 95. And I moved to Utah, and went to college, moved in with some of my high school buddies in Utah. My parents were like, what? You're moving to Utah. I'm like, yeah. They're like, are you Mormon now? Like, what's going on? I'm like, nope. I had a really good time in Utah one time. There's beautiful mountains, and I think there's a university there.
So doing that, well, one thing, I guess mid-90s, you were sort of moving up to that next level, probably was, you were kind of right in the height of everybody supplementing their racing with training methods.
It was interesting. I raced for a Dutch team, Dutch Valuven, and we had four Estonian guys on the team. So basically it was me and another American and four Estonians, and we lived in this sport club above us at a soccer complex. So there was like a supporters bar, there was the main playing pitch, and then there was like six training pitches around this facility, and it actually had a velodrome, which was completely dilapidated, but we lived above the bar. The Estonian guys were definitely on a program. I didn't really know what was going on, but they would get up in the middle of the night and like do wind sprints down the hall. And I was like, dude, am I missing out on some secret training? Like, is there something I don't know about? Like, what's going on? So I would talk to the manager, and he would just be like, Chris, you know, don't worry about it, man. You're a sportsman. Don't worry about it. And I never really understood that until, you know, I kind of called one of my teammates out on it. And he was like, look, dude, I can move back to Estonia and burn car tires for a living and die when I'm 55 from breathing that, or I can do this, scratch out a little money and, you know, die when I'm 65.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And I was just like, whoa, I can go to junior college for the rest of my life. I can pump gas in Oregon. I can work for the U.S. Postal Service. Oh my God, I have options. You know, my mind was just blown by this, and it never really struck me before that this wasn't sport to the most people in Europe, you know?
For sure.
This is a job, and this is a way to make money. And I was just like, huh, okay, this isn't American Flyers.
Yeah, and I think that is something that is definitely something that us who love cycling and also want to pretend that, you know, we can do some races on some level, we have that emotional and moral attachment to it that I don't think the rest of the world or parts of the world do. And I always
I always look at it like NFL football. They're kind of the same way. There's no
right.
There's no attachment like that to it. It's like it's a job and you do what you do. It still sucks, but you know.
And I mean, we had the Americans go bad there for a bit, you know, and that was probably just out of sheer frustration and like, I don't know, it's just a mess. I struggle with professional cycling with all that stuff, but I still find the beauty in it.
Yeah.
You know, I just watched that movie star show on Netflix and I was just like, loved it. Loved every minute of it. The emotion of the directors, the passion from the directors, just I'm like, oh, I've been on both sides of that, and it's just like such a beautiful thing that I kind of I don't give it a pass per se, but I still am a super fan
for sure. And that's what makes it, I think, so frustrating. I still look back at those you know, Tour de France's in the early 2000s. You're like, God, they're just the most exciting races out there, and So here's one thing, and I just wonder if this was always kind of your mentality, or this sort of hard knocks European training might have molded it some. One thing that I love about how you work with your athletes is on the mental side, and it's really a almost like them against the world. I mean, you put this toughness into the athletes that you coach, which you don't see throughout cycling, at least. And has that always been your take on it, or am I like couching that incorrectly?
I don't know. I mean, I think everyone I work with requires a different approach. You know, there might be, you know, subtlety to the differences. I mean, the sport is hard, you know, and I think of it as this, we're perishable goods. Like if you're going to do this, you have till this, you have an expiration date. With the women, I think it's a little bit different with women. I think they can still succeed longer or even start later and still succeed, to whatever degree we want to define success as. But like, on the men's side, I don't think there's not that much opportunity for that type of longevity. It's rare, you know, it's rare. So I just kind of drill that home. And then, you know, I'm kind of the accountability officer. I mean, I'm not your buddy. So if you're trying to two-step dance around something with me, get out of doing something that you need to do, then I'm not going to just be like, okay.
Well, that's, you know, for the times that I did hire a coach just for my amateur pursuits, that was my number one reason for doing it, is I wanted somebody to be accountable to. That's what I want. I didn't want them to say, oh, it's okay if you didn't do this or anything else. That's what I need. I'm paying you. I need you to make sure that I'm accountable for what we've decided I want to do. That was kind of the job.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because what the rider needs is constantly in flux. So you have to wear this face that you knew the answer before the question kind of thing, you know, because they need that stability, you know.
And this is also coaching on a whole different, this isn't like cookie cutter, you know, you might have 50 athletes and they're all kind of doing the same thing at the elite level. And that's what I appreciate with what you do, is that you really do. You are personally vested in what they want to accomplish, which I think is great to see.
Yeah. I mean, you know, let's face it. I don't know too many coaches that make stellar livings. So it's like, I have to have, like, I'm motivated. I have motivations with the athletes I work with, you know, like I want to be involved with the world champion. That is one of my biggest goals, and it's totally plausible. I think, you know, missing, I think the women's junior category would have been the most optimal opportunity for that, but we missed that big time. So, I think USA Cycling missed that big time too, like a little bit too late, but that was like when I was over in at the World Championships in Luxembourg and they had announced that Junior Worlds were coming, I was talking to Jim Miller straight away. I was like, this is where we're headed, dude. This is where we've got to be going. And he was like, yeah. You know, let's do this.
And that was kind of your team, right? In 2017.
Yep. Yeah. 16, 17. I ran all the blocks in 16. Proctor had not done it or wasn't doing it. So I stepped in and took over for Jeff. We ran October, November, December in Worlds. Probably had 50 to 60 athletes in all those blocks exposed to European racing. And then when I came back, you know, Jim and Mark Gullickson flew me out to USA Cycling in Colorado Springs, and we talked about the future. And it just didn't, by June, it was clear it wasn't going to work out.
Mm. Yeah. What do you think, I mean, looking back on that time that you were able to lead those teams, what do you think the biggest success stories were for you?
I mean, for me, it's different because, you know, you have the first, I really liked working with the first time kids. Like I had Caleb Swartz, I had Lane Maher, I had, you know, Ben Gomez, Scott Funston, Calder Woods, you know, these kids that are all first, second, third year U23s now. And it was all their first World Cups, their first races, and just, you know, creating an environment for them where they're like, you know, they all kind of knew each other from summer camps, maybe, and maybe some mountain bike racing, but you really see them grow together as friends, and they learn to help each other, support each other, because it's tough. It's super tough over there. And everyone wants to wear a brave face. And so once you let your guard down and just kind of, I feel like the strength is in the numbers, you know, instead of just like, I'm strong, I'm whatever. I feel like everyone raises the bar. So I would say the junior kids were big. You know, some of my biggest, you know, Tobin over there, we got him into the top 20 of the world that year. You know, that was huge. Seeing Becca, the first time I ever saw Becca race actually was in Belgium at a midweek Wednesday mudder, and she was podiumed. And I was just like, oh my God, that chicken tractor pull. She can't get off her bike. She can't get on her bike. She can't shoulder her bike. She can't do any of that stuff. But my God, she just tractor pulled with Ellen Van Looy.
So speaking of Becca, she's one, and you know, I've had this conversation with her too, but I think the thing that really you did for her was kind of goes back to what I was talking about a couple minutes ago, was you kind of gave her the green light to allow herself to say it's okay to win a race and to think that you can win a race. That seems to be like a huge change in her progression over the last 2 years.
Yeah. Becca is, I absolutely love working with Becca. She is great. Her critical thought process is identifiable to me, but interesting at the same time. So I kind of have to know when to let it roll and when to just like stick my foot out and trip her kind of, but she's game for it. Like she's up for it. She's got no like reservations. Like, I don't think we've ever had like some, you know, where I've said something that she took the wrong way and she got upset about, or vice versa. She's just very like, okay, what did you mean by that? Like, you know, you know how Beck is.
Yep.
She's direct and I love that.
Yeah.
She wants something very big and I want her to get that, and we're working towards it. So.
Yeah. And the great thing with her is that you saw such great progression and results from her this year. Yet at the end of it, she's still, you know, I think probably would say successful season, but the same thing, was still disappointed at some of the things that didn't go the way she wanted them to go and felt like she still had more to give. So that's kind of cool looking forward for her.
Yeah. You know, at Nationals, I met her at the finish line and, you know, what a great day for her. I was running around the course screaming at her like the entire time to like stay on the gas, 'cause I know she checks out occasionally, you know, and I was happy for her. I was genuinely happy for her. And she just gave me one of her, and she like didn't even want to like, she barely even wanted to high five. I was just like, come on, like, come on. But
yeah.
Yeah. But I also know that that's good. Like, I really like it when people are hungry and never satisfied. Even if she would have won Nationals, like the next day I would want to get a phone call from her saying, okay, I'm winning a World Cup next year. Yeah.
That'd be awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I was thinking back when you mentioned Nationals, but I think we hung out for a little bit on top of one of the run-ups during the practice day. And this is what I will tell you, Chris, and I think this is sort of this was interesting for me to see, and just with your experience in coaching a lot of these people, was, and you may not have noticed it, but the respect that you were given from a lot of those riders, because they would be coming up there and you'd just be standing there, you'd watch them, and they would turn to you, not your clients, but athletes, you know, and they'd be like, what do you think about that? You know, or, yeah, and they'd be looking at you to sort of give them that tip, give them that advice, just standing up there at the top, which was nice. It was good to see.
It's cool. I love the American cross scene. I think there's so much potential. I think everyone has so much, like, there's so much low lying fruit for everybody. And just, you could say one thing to someone that could change their entire race.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's just fun.
So on the other side of that, I want to go back to like the you and Tobin a couple years ago.
Yes.
That was like a gang. It was like a very small gang. And
yeah.
We talked about like your role with Becca and then your role with Tobin at that time. I mean, you guys, just the way you work together and we're in it. And we've gone back and forth, me and him, about this. And I think he kind of misunderstood my take on things at times, but it was like you guys against the world. And I think it worked. I mean, I think it was a successful formula, but it was kind of cool to see, because it really just sort of threw this whole new element into the scene.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I worked with Tobin. I'm actually not working with Tobin anymore.
Yeah.
I've been working with him since before he had a driver's license. Mm. So the things that we accomplished, were always like kind of shit giggling. Just like, I can't believe I just pulled that off. You know, it's just like, yeah, dude, you did. Yeah. That's cause you're a badass, you know? And so when he was in Cal Giant, with, whether it was on the road, he was always on the outside on the road team, because he wasn't a roadie. You know, he didn't want to be a roadie, but he was by far one of their best sprinters, you know. And, you know, he'd medal at U23 Crit Nationals. He was the best young rider at North Star Grand Prix, you know, like getting in big breakaways and taking sprint points away from big sprinters, you know, just like he's a good rider. But he never wanted to be a roadie, and you know, he didn't want to associate like that. And then, like, in Cal Giant, on the cross program, he was always just the little dirt jumping kid that Anthony led on the team. And even when he started to surpass results wise, bike handling wise, he was always just kind of like shit on a little bit. And I would sit there as his coach and just sit there and watch the mechanics, like, just talk down to him all the time. Like that. It was like the environment was kind of passive aggressive. Tobin's the little kid, pick on him. Mm. And he was always, he just wanted to be everyone's bro and was like, ha 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 ha. But you could tell it upset him. It ruffled his feathers. So when Cal Giant folded, we were going to start this privateer thing. I was like, look, dude, let's create the bubble. Let's create Tobinville. Like, everything for you, period. No compromise. And, you know, you don't have to deal with that.
Yeah. And I think that paid off for y'all, but it was a neat time. And I think, yeah, especially what you were talking about with Tobin's sprint ability, you know, that was the, just talking to everybody else that was racing against him, there was that conspiracy against him in every race that it was going to be, get rid of Tobin as soon as possible, so we don't have to deal with him in a sprint.
Well, they didn't believe it until, I guess, Rochester, you know. And, you know, this is what I always told him, because he was just famous for, like, being there when it was down to nine guys, and then he would get popped and he would just choose not to go hard for one more second and just make that split. And I was like, dude, if you ride this like a crit, you make the split, it's game over. Like, all you got to do is set it up and pimp them. And no one's going to expect you to attack. No one's going to expect you to, like, take big turns. And you can get away with that for about 4 to 6 weeks. You can get away with that. And so I think that vernacular of, like, kind of race it like a crit sunk in with him. He was like, oh.
Looking at where we are with domestic cyclocross now? I mean, I want to get a little bit into the goals and missions of USA Cycling, because I know you definitely played a little role in that with your time there and had ideas about what could work going forward. But just even before that, even before the global, what's your take just on where we're at with cyclocross in the U.S. and this is the problem I have with this conversation sometimes, is that people are always like, yeah, well, it's, you know, juniors can't do this or amateurs can't do this. I'm just talking about, like, you know, the cream of the crop, the top elites that we're looking at, you know. Yeah. what's the future look like for the sport at the top?
Well, I think it's interesting. Like, if you throw, you know, a couple of euros into the mix, it changes completely. If you go a couple of our top guys and go race in Europe, it's not competitive. So yeah, you sit there and ask yourself, well, why? It's fast. The power to weight ratio is this. What's going on? You know, and what I believe, one of the biggest things I see is obviously speed and repeatability of effort. Like, you know, our guys can get in there and hang for three laps for the first third, and then it's just diminished returns. Whereas the Euros just keep going. And I think you also, if you look at the Euros bike, whether they're running a 1x or a 2x, they're on a 46 tooth chainring, an 11:28 or a 10:33. And they're pedaling higher RPM. So, I mean, do the math. They're going faster. You know, I noticed Vanderpool runs 170 cranks on his cross bikes. Like, that dude's 6 what?
Yeah, he's tall. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, why is he running shorter cranks? Well, probably so he can, you know, how many 10-second attacks or blips over threshold does that guy have in an hour? 800? I mean, who knows? It's like...
Do you think that's changed? Because I remember talking to Powers, like, within the last, I guess, had to be 6-7 years now, and his whole thing was that he felt like he was winning races with that high cadence in the U.S. and that he needed to completely scrap that for lower cadence to be able to work through sand, work through mud in Europe. Has the European racing changed so that's no longer the case?
No, I don't think so. I think that's one piece of it. You need to have that neuromuscular endurance, right? But you also have to have that snap and that ability to repeat that snap over and over and over and over and over again without the decreased capacity going too low to where it's effective anymore, right? You can watch the body language in the second and thirds of the races where people are still jumping out of turns, but it's not with the same vigor. Whereas in Europe, it's actually getting more violent, you know, as the race progresses. So I think there's a neuromuscular component to that. Also think mechanically it's skeletal. You know, you're pedaling with leverage. You're using your foot, your femur, and the crank arm. So that's your bone. You know, how effective are you doing that?
What do you think moving forward that, you know, USA Cycling is doing right? And what do you think, what would you see as sort of what else can be done as far as gaining more success in Europe?
Well, I think it's moving in the right direction with just the amount of riders going over. I do think that we need to have a selection criteria, a different selection criteria for the riders that are going over, especially, you know, we obviously have to start with the youth. We can't really, take a guy who's finishing 15th, who's 28 years old at, you know, NoHo and be like, hey, we're going to take you to Europe. Sorry, I don't mean any offense to that. I mean, you can go race over there, but I don't think that the USA Cycling should be investing in that rider per se. But the juniors in the U23, both men and women, obviously they should. Jesse did that this year. I feel like, you know, that Jesse was kind of at a disadvantage with how late everything was kind of given. And those blocks, I know I had riders that were asked, you know, 10 days before the block started, hey, can your kid miss 3 weeks of school and go race in Europe? So I think that was challenging to get, you know, to get that commitment. But I think that you need exposure. There needs to be a program that has some progression. that isn't looking at the American cross, you know, like you can have good 20 minute power and be terrible at bike driving and be a good cross racer in the US.
Right.
You don't have to be a cyclocrosser. In Europe, it's a different matrix. You have to have great driving, great threshold power, great 5 minute power, great 20 second power. And you know, great technical ability, and you got to be able to run pretty good. you know, if you ask how many athletes run 3 days a week year round in the US, I bet you it'd be less than 10%.
Do you, with your athletes, I actually want to get into this with you about your own running, but is that something that you stress pretty hard with the athletes that you coach?
Yeah. I mean, if for nothing else, weight bearing exercise is really good for your bone health. So running is just a good way to get that in 20 minutes. You know, 3 20-minute runs a week is really enough to create base, if you would. The efficiencies you can find from running efficiencies, like a shorter stride, a more upright posture. When you get off the bike and you have that type of economy and running, you can get back on the bike and hit out really hard. You're not like gassed from the run.
Yeah.
I think it's super important.
All right. Let's get into your running. I feel like this is what has kept your competitive drive alive after the bike racing stopped. You do like ultra marathon. Is that right?
I do. Yeah.
How did that start?
Yeah. That's a good question. I have always really enjoyed being in the mountains. I always, you know, you get up on a big ridge line, the wind picks up, it starts snowing or something. It just like makes me feel alive. And so running in that environment, you know, you can just get further in quicker. You know, you can just get further in, basically. I think that's how it started for me. I'd go run with some friends and they'd just be like, dude, you know, you're fast. You should go do a local race or something. And there's, you know, I live pretty close to Auburn where Western States is. And there's an ultra race every weekend, you know, whether it's a 50K or 100 mile, there's a race every weekend. So I would just put my foot in the water. And the first race I did was like a 35K. And I won it, and I got to the finish line before they had it set up.
Amazing.
And I was like, hey, I think I just won. They were like, what? Yeah. So then I was like, ooh, this is great. But with Nordic ski, I Nordic ski raced a ton too. And I raced like for Rosignol and I just love the thrashing of yourself. But I was also like, there's no mistake. Nordic skiing and ultra running, there is no chance in hell you could ever make a living doing it. So don't be, you know, like with bike racing, you're like, oh, I could probably make a living doing this. So with these things, it's just pure passion, you know?
So what's the longest race that you've done?
Longest race I have done is a 100K. Mm.
Yeah. And what is the mindset? How do you sort of get yourself into either just training or racing and just that distance and just that, just getting through that? I mean, what's the method?
Well, the training part, I mean, I probably run 60 to 90 miles a week. Just that consistency is key, you know, and then just basically, you know, advert, taper, it's pretty similar. You know, there's key things you need to work on.
Yeah.
But really, for me, it's about aerobic capacity and like really increasing that time to cardiac drift. Like how long can I stay aerobic without cardiac drift? Mm. You know, cause you can go on a 3 hour ride and average 140 heart rate. And then you go on a 4 hour ride and that same effort and your heart rate's like 155 or 160. You're like, what? So trying to like, keep that cardiac drift time or elongate that time. And I mean, you're just in your head your whole time, the whole time when you're doing a race like that, you know, 9, 11 hours out there just running. You know, you're just like constantly checking the systems and talking positive, you know, trying to make sure your economy is good, you're eating, you're drinking, you're fixing what needs fixed. It's just, it's, yeah. I mean, last summer it was kind of funny. I did a 100K race in Ashland, Oregon. I was sixth overall, the oldest guy by a long way. And then I got in my car, drove to Portland, got on an airplane, flew to Helena, Montana, and started coaching Montana cross camp the next morning. That was brutal.
Oh, I am sure. I'll bet just getting on that plane must have been like tough. Oh.
But I got like 2 hours north of Ashland in my van, and I had to stop and like walk around because I was like, my legs were all twitchy, and I was like, oh man, what's going on? How am I going to make this?
Yeah, I don't think you get a better, bigger duality from doing a 9 to 11 hour run to going to training for, you know, or coaching people who are doing 45, 50 to 60 minute races.
Well, and you know, there's 3 training sessions a day at Montana Cross Camp. And a classroom session at night. So it's like there's no rest. And so I basically just had to treat it like a stage race. I was just like, okay, I just put myself in stage race brain, like do what you got to do. Do what you got to do. Make the time cut.
All right. Through your racing or bike racing career or even coaching, give me one of these stories that just stands out, just like crazy or great or whatever that you always look back on and go, man, that was a day.
Well, I can't like from like emotional feeling, I would probably say San Francisco Grand Prix the first year. That was incredible. That trumped Manny Unkwal, that trumped US Pro as far as like the goosebumps. That was pretty amazing. I mean, who's raced 125 miles in downtown San Francisco with like 40,000 feet of climbing or whatever it was. Yeah. That was actually the first year I did that was with Micah actually.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. I would say, you know, from a cyclocross point of view, I didn't do great at the PIR Nationals in Portland, but I will never, ever forget when that drum corps marched in. I don't know if you've ever heard about that.
No.
This 100 piece drum corps marched in. We're all in the grid, you know, and it was just so Portland, you know. And they're dressed up, you know, they're like carnival style, like carny style, you know, like unique drum corps people, not like professional drum corps people. It wasn't like the local college drum corps. And this is people's, and it was just off the hook. And they were playing like Metallica songs, and like it was just amazing. But like that like got me so stirred up. That was pretty cool. I didn't have a great day that day, but it was pretty cool. I don't really dwell too much on like great. I mean, I don't know. It's so, you have so many, you have, I mean, you could probably count the great days on one hand over 40 years or whatever. Yeah. So it's more like a, I don't know.
How did you get into building frames?
Building frames. Okay. So like when I turned professional, so I should back up a little bit. My first real road bike was a Gorchiotti. I actually had a Nishiki Prestige before that, which was great. But then I got a Gorchiotti, which was amazing. And then I got a Roland Della Santa, which was amazing. And then we rode Le Mans and it was just amazing. And then I turned professional and, the first bike I had professional was a compact geometry aluminum carbon K2, the ski company.
Right.
And I had like a 14 centimeter stem with like 2 inch of staff spacers above the headset and like 420 seat post. I mean, it was just, and the thing, like if you like even initiated your turn, it wanted to do 360 degree turn. So like just descending on this bike was just terrifying.
Oh man.
And then it just, the bikes just got worse through the professional rigs. Like for me, like they just weren't, I could, you know, like on my Della Santa, I always joke, like I could go down a descent at 60 eating a sandwich with my hands off the bars. Yeah. So when I retired from bike racing, I had to give my bikes back to the last team or you don't get your last paycheck. You know, it's kind of how it is. And so I didn't have a bike and I had a aluminum Kona cross bike that I was, cause I was a coach at Rad Racing. So I had one of the Rad Jake cross bikes and, I put some road tires on it and didn't even change the gearing. I had 46, 38 and I just started doing like my normal long rides on it and up in the mountains. And I was like, my God, this thing descends like my Della Santa. So I started like really going down the rabbit hole trying to figure out why. Of course, it came down to like chain stay length, bottom bracket drop and stuff like that. And then I, in the meantime, I'd started racing cyclocross for Rock Lobster and Paul Sadoff.
Mm-hmm.
And so Paul, I'd be like, okay, what if we did a 68.5 millimeter BB drop instead of 68 mils? He'd just be like, dude, settle down. Okay. Well, what if my chainstays were 425 instead of 422? And he'd be like, dude, settle down. And so finally he was like, you need to go build a bike. And he was an instructor at United Bicycle Institute in Ashland, Oregon. He taught a steel class up there. And so he's like, you should go take the class. And he told me, take a titanium frame building class up there. If you can build a titanium bike, I'd never even welded before. I'd never even run a mill or a lathe or anything. I'd never done anything like that. He said, if you can come out of that 2-week course with a bike that rides well, you can do absolutely anything. And I built a tight cross bike. It was straight and I won several cross races on it and I never looked back.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Now you're building carbon bikes now. That's gotta be a change.
Yeah. So, I mean, carbon is tough for me. It's an easier process. It's a more expensive process. Materials are more expensive. The equipment's more expensive. Everything's more expensive and you sell less frames because of the price tag.
Right.
Versus, you know, buying a bike from overseas where the kid got paid $12 an hour to do the layup.
Right. Yeah.
Which is brutal. And I can't compete with that and I don't want to.
Yeah, for sure. But yours are like fully customized.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Full custom. But I do steel. I do steel carbon. I actually, right before we got on the call, I just finished brazing a top tube into a frame.
Nice. Perfect.
Yeah.
People still buying bikes.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got some bikes in the queue, so that's good.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. Anything else we need to cover here?
I don't know, man. How about you? How are you hanging on? How long are you're going to keep pushing this donkey cart?
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's funny. Cause it's like, I think that we all go through, I don't know. I can't speak for anybody else. This past season was really long. You know,
yeah.
I think that what I personally set out to do and wanted to do and making it all the way through and then sort of extending to a couple trips to Belgium and then, you know, going to Worlds. But by the time Worlds was done, I was like, and looking at the calendar and going, okay, I have, you know, 4 weeks and then mountain bike season starts and yeah, right into it.
Yeah.
I was like, oh boy, this is tough. But I don't know. It gets to that. And then it's a couple weeks of just downtime and then just ready to go again.
Yeah.
You know, so it's
the wanderlust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is like, it's great being home, but you know, I miss it. I miss being at races.
Yeah.
I just miss that. And it's the same thing. It's, I love the racing. I also, between mountain bike and cyclocross, those communities, I think are just wonderful communities in the US, actually North America. And I miss that a ton.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I know it's the scene. It's so good. It's a family, you know, it's a home away from home. And man, I just hope we get to race cross this year. Yeah.
Well, let's keep positive that we'll be out there. And Chris, I look forward to seeing you in person at one of those early races, assuming that we have it going on.
And thanks for doing everything you're doing. I love the content. I love it. It's always good.
I appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Yeah, man.